morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you for being here today. We are going to be continuing testimony on Senate Bills 494 and Senate Bill 768. I'm going to go ahead and open up public hearings. These are continuing from the hearing that we had this last Thursday for both of those two bills. If you remember, colleagues, Senate Bill 494 is the bill dealing with advanced directives, establishing the committee that would be in existence to make a new form for the advanced directives. And the Senate Bill 768 is basically establishing or would be establishing operating a statewide registry for collecting and disseminating advanced directives. So those are the two bills that we have up for public hearing currently. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to first call up Roger Martin and allow Roger to give his testimony. Then we'll come back and we'll pick up Kay Bridges, and I'll make a statement on that, and Calm Willis are the ones that we have scheduled. It is possible that the chair may want to bring up Tom Holt, who has been part of the work group as well as assisting on other components of the advanced directives, and possibly Gail Atterbury. Roger, if you'd like to go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. That's the organization that speaks for the Portland Archdiocese and the Baker Diocese, the two parts of the Catholic Church in Oregon. I appreciate being able to do this, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for not having me testify in that heated atmosphere last Friday. I appreciate this. We oppose Senate Bill 494 because of the, in our opinion, foreseeable consequences of what is going to happen if this bill passes. We are not opposed to advanced directives. We support and concur with the current advanced directive. But we're concerned about what I say, the foreseeable consequences, and let me explain. If you look up in the term death with dignity, that lexicon was introduced not just 20 years ago, but 50 years ago in the Oregon legislature. I can tell you that because I was a member at the time when former Senator Ted Halleck first raised the subject of death with dignity. And ever since then, we have been arguing what that really means. My concern, and I expressed it 50 years ago, is this is a slippery slope, and we're going to start down that. And I was told at the time, well, Roger, stop exaggerating. Well, 30 years ago, we ended up with death with dignity, meaning Oregon's assisted suicide law. Now, that only comes into this. We, as I say, support the advanced directives now, but we are concerned about people, the vulnerable elderly people, with Alzheimer's, who depend totally on someone else for the rest of their life. And we are concerned that this current bill changes the advance directive. It's going to open up the possibility of a committee other than yours, other than the legislative committee, making decisions about what that all means. And, you know, I was told I was exaggerating back then. Let me remind you that in other countries, for instance, Holland, active euthanasia is practiced. We are very much opposed to that possibility. We're concerned that this opens up some opportunities to do that, and that's the reason, Mr. Chairman, we oppose the bill.
All right. Questions for Roger. Roger, I do have a couple of questions. I need to put some stuff on the record.
Yes.
I understand that the position that your clients are taking. Could you please point out exactly where in the bill differs from what the existing advanced directives language is? I'm just trying to find out why there's a concern based on the temporary rule that is in the bill.
Mr. Chair, and I wished I could be more specific. It's changes in some of the wording. It's the fact that a committee other than the legislature is going to make these decisions, even if they come back and have to be approved by you. We want you directly involved in that.
So let me ask you then, Roger, we have a numerous other, representations of this type of form, a model of governance, the Oregon's Council on Court Procedures. It is a body that was established in 1979, now been in effect for 38 years, And it also has the same type of a perspective of modeling as this is called for in Senate Bill 494 for this this commission, this committee, to actually basically have the ability to make changes to the farm, then have them actually be required to be produced to the legislature. In other words, have to be submitted. And then it gives the legislature the opportunity, if they choose to do so, to take it up and make modifications, or if not, then whatever has been deemed by that committee, in this case, the Council for the Court Procedures, to go in effect. So what is the difference between these two that causes your client's concern?
Mr. Chair, I can thankfully say I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to get in a legal debate with you because I'm outnumbered. The consequences and the issues that that other procedure deals with, in our opinion, are not nearly as consequential as the lives involved, and that's simply the reason we are concerned about what we feel are going to be the inevitable consequences of change in this law.
Any other questions, Senator Manning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this question would be directed towards you, Mr. Chair. The original bill or the original form, who orchestrated or who designed that original form? Was it the same committee or was it someone else?
We'll have to ask counsel. We have legislative counsel here I can bring up to answer that question, but what I can tell you is that it was formulated through the legislative process. It was, in fact, placed in statute. It's been in statute for 23 years. My review of the statute as it reads today and looking at the temporary rule as to the farm and the model of the farm for the actual advance directives are virtually identical. Not quite, but virtually identical.
Okay, follow up if I may. So we're talking about the form itself. Now, anybody, is this a state mandate that everybody fill out this form, or is this one of those that you are volunteer if you choose to use this form?
It is completely voluntary on the purse of the individual who may be seeking to be able to have some type of focus and direction given to those that would be overseeing their ending years, days of their life. So it is completely voluntary. No one's obligated to do this. This is basically, and even if you may want to do it, it has to have a go through the test of competency, ensuring the individual is, in fact, have the mental wherewithal to understand what they're doing and that they actually want to go forward. The farm that's currently proposed does make a couple of modifications. One of them specifically, instead of requiring you to have two witnesses to actually watch you execute the document, you can actually use a notary. So this is one of the things I believe that the committee was looking at. How do you assist an individual in making these decisions and being able to formulate it? And so that is one of the two changes that are done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So when we have LC come up, we'll be able to have a little more discussion on that. Any other questions or comments for, regarding Roger Martin's testimony? Mr. Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. At this point, we're going to go ahead and call Kay Bridges up. Good morning, Ms. Bridges.
Kay Bridges.
And before you get started, I just want to make certain that we're on the same page. As, at the request of the President's office, you've been permitted to come back to give testimony on Senate Bill 494, as well as if you want to give testimony on the other bill, which I believe is Senate Bill 768. Please remember that the testimony that you're going to give needs to be germane to the bill itself, as to what the bill is establishing as the committee to move forward and preparing a form that would be reviewed by the legislature within 4 years. Go right ahead.
Okay. Chair Pavlansky and committee, I do appreciate the opportunity to give my testimony. I deeply appreciate it. I'm in opposition to Senate Bill 494 as it stands now. I have several concerns, and I'll concentrate on the portions that concern me the most and support them with reasons why I take that position. And Section 2, the Advanced Directive Rules Adoption Committee. This committee described in the bill removes the responsibility of the form for the Advanced Directive from the legislative to a committee appointed by the governor. The form is submitted to interim committees related to health care and judiciary, but does not provide for the same public hearings as the one we are attending at this moment. There's an effort to assure that the members of the committee are experts in their field. They will meet at least twice a year, and though they are unpaid, they will receive reimbursement for travel and other expenses. And there's no oversight or limit to these expenses. During the first 5 years of this temporary form that is in 494, they may meet 10 times and be reimbursed for expenses. For what? The members conceivably could be paid by an employer while they are attending those meetings and then be reimbursed by the taxpayer. For what? We are not reimbursed for our travel here. We come to the legislature to testify, and this committee should not be paid or reimbursed either. Another committee with no oversight of expenses is not appropriate or prudent. This bill would add another layer of bureaucracy, of experts. These same experts could be invited to testify before the legislature. Legislators could seek advice from these experts. The legislators are the representatives of the people of Oregon. Taking the decision-making for this form out of the legislative process that we have today is wrong. The people you as legislators are supposed to represent would no longer be represented. At the very least, I would like to see different criteria for the members of the committee were this to pass. The most troubling part is that all the members are insulated in their expertise, and none of the members are laypeople or family members who have taken care of, been with the family members during the time an advance directive was signed, and the subsequent demise of that person. The professional sees only the downside of the situation. A layperson may have a completely different view. The professional or expert views are more for the situation instead of the protection of the principal. I am more concerned about people like my parents and others, and for myself at age 80. I also have a concern that trying to update my form with current information and addresses will be cumbersome because I do not want to use this new form. My mother injured, I will now tell you why I take these positions, the circumstances that I experienced. My mother injured her big toe. Gangrene developed even though doctors were treating it. I fired the doctor and the surgeon. They had scheduled to remove her toe. We got rid of the gangrene in 2 weeks, and it was confirmed by a doctor. They were all experts, but they had differences of opinions. My daughter was ill. Surgery was recommended, and she developed Klebsiella pneumoniae in the hospital. My research at OHSU convinced the doctor to administer the preferred antibiotic for 3 days instead of two. That was the new research. The surgery did not fix the problem. We went to 35 doctors. 34 of them were wrong. The 35th found that she had mercury toxicity. When my father had a heart attack, he landed on a respirator due to post-polio syndrome. We'd dealt with that before. The pulmonary specialist said to find a care center for him because he'd never be able to take care of himself again at age 86. He went home and had the best 2 years he'd had in 15. He found the right doctor after that. And the great-grandchildren had a memory of him that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And number four, I cared for my mother 24/7 for 2 years after she had a stroke. I had to lie to get her out of the hospital because the attending physician wrote an order that I couldn't possibly take care of her adequately and she would need to be in a nursing home. I signed the form. I lied. Due to another case I was involved with, where I had police come to my home to interrogate me, I had consulted an attorney who told me that had my mother had money or property without a trust in place, they probably would have taken her away from me. I was lucky she had no money or property. The doctor I also go to now said that she was in better health under my care, except for the permanent effects of the stroke. After the second stroke, when paralyzed on one side, she was sent home on hospice. The hospice changed my order for hospice without my knowledge until the day they showed up with a hospital bed. When I demanded it be changed back, they said I would have to put her on a couch until the new bill, until the new bed arrived. They wouldn't believe me when I said she had full control of her bladder because I asked for a slip pan or a chair. She only used Depends when she'd had, because she'd had leaky bowels after contracting an infection when she was in the hospital the first time. I couldn't leave her, and they wouldn't believe me. Those were the experts. Number five, my shop, someone outside my family. My shop began delivering Monday flowers in 1981, and I have continued the practice. I was delivering to an extremely overweight woman that was in a care center after breaking her leg. They did not believe me when I told them that she fixed dinner for her 90-year-old mother every night. They thought her incapable. And there's that word that's used in the 494. Even before the broken leg, they thought she had been, must have been incapable. Many of the employees in the facility who cared for her spoke very little English. Would they do anything but follow a supervisor's instructions if asked to witness a document? I doubt it. These are the reasons that I do not want a committee of experts to determine what this form should look like or for the changes in the law to take place. These experts you would have on the committee are only doing their job. They seldom have the kind of experience that family members have. They don't see the successes because no one writes about them. Here in this committee, in this legislative process, is where you will hear the successes, the problems, and the successes. I do believe there are more safeguards for the principal who signs this form in the current legislative process, which gives me the right to testify here today. This is the process I learned from my mentor when I ran for state representative, Senator Vic Atiyah, before he was governor. It is a system which may not be perfect, but it gives us citizen input. And on page 9, line 25, the witness declaration should include the person is not an employee of those persons listed in that section. Page 11, section 8, lines 35, 36, and 37. And it would also be in page, on page 12, 5, lines 14 to 18 in my written testimony, where the witness should not be an employee or designated by that facility. It should be a disinterested party, and those people are definitely not disinterested because they have JOBs concerning the situation. I respectfully submit, K.O. Bridges, Portland, Oregon. Any questions?
Let's see if there are any questions.
Is this submitted to OLIS?
Pardon me?
Do we have an electronic copy?
It's been electronically submitted, and there are extra copies on the table if anyone in the room would like one of the copies of my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Bridges.
All right, Ms. Bridges, I want to, Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Ms. Chair. Ms. Bridges, so do you have an advance directive for yourself? Or
yes, I do.
Did your mother have one?
My mother did not have one.
Okay. And how did that change things?
It's the how did what change things?
I mean, the fact that she did or did not have an advance directive. You know, what we're trying to do here is provide advance, you know, people the opportunity.
Oh, I'm totally in support of the advance directive. And in fact, my form, I think, has safeguards in it that the new form does not. I could go on for another 10 minutes, but I don't want to take your time for that. I stuck to the very germane things. And the most crucial thing to me right now is the people who would be on this committee and the fact that you would actually take that process away, even though they can submit to the legislature. That doesn't give us public testimony like we have today. you know, you spend a little time, or as much time as I did, when Senator Attia supported me before he became governor. You have a conviction that is everlasting and will never go away, and that is why I am here today, is because I do believe in the public testimony and the public input instead of this committee, as it's designated in here.
All right. Ms. Bridges, first of all, I want to thank you for being much more attuned to what is germane in the bill and focusing your testimony today.
Well, I really was.
So I really appreciate.
I now have a lot of notes just on the bill that I copied.
Let's just say it's much more succinct than it was on Thursday. So let me ask you a couple questions, though. You've just made a statement that you fully support advanced directives. It sounds to me some of the examples you gave, in specifically regarding your mother, that you made conscious decisions on her behalf to ensure that she was taken care of while she was in the healthcare facilities. Is that correct?
She was in the hospital. I signed it that I would put her in a facility, which was a lie, but it was the only way I could get her out of the hospital.
But you made some other statements on your testimony that you helped direct some of the treatment that she received while she was in the hospital. And I guess to me that sounds very similar to how an advanced directive would work. So let me ask you regarding your specific.
I totally agree with you, but it was the combination of all of these experiences that probably lead me to say that we need the public input from people like me that have experienced these things. And not everybody has gone through what I did. But I know the experts have been wrong so many times, and when you want to put together a committee of experts, I completely object to that, because those experts could be called in by Senator Lithicum, Senator Thatcher, Senator Dembrough, Senator Manning. You could all have access to those same people without paying them and reimbursing them.
So, Ms. Bridges, let me just clarify on the record. There are a number of commissions, councils, task forces that are established under law where the individuals, because of the length of time that they're serving and because of their obligations to the state, that they are, in fact, paid for their reasonable travel expenses, usually mileage, and sometimes overnight staying. That is just how our process has worked from the legislature for different committees and councils. Not all of them are like that, but this is one that, and I appreciate you believe that in this particular case that's not, but I just want to put on the record, this isn't something new and different.
Oh, I understand that totally.
I appreciate that. I just want to make sure the record also reflects that. But I do want to ask you one other question regarding the two farms, the farm that is currently in statute today that we are operating under versus what has been brought forward as our temporary farm while this commission would be meeting to establish a new and different farm. Have you found any differences in it that causes you concern between the two farms?
Yes, but I didn't want to take time to go into that part today because I was concentrating completely on the biggest concern for me.
Okay.
At this
is that
point.
Within
but yes, my form personally, for instance, also says that the alternate must be consulted if available as well. I have concerns also that, for instance, the person I have designated is out of the state 5 months out of the year. And how is there any oversight or how is there any proof of the type of effort to reach her? So I have those kinds of concerns as well, but the major one still was the committee and its construction and its removal from the legislative process.
And do you understand that as the principal, the individual that's signing, entering into and signing the executive, advanced directives, is actually the individual who actually chooses and selects who their principal healthcare representative is?
Of course.
And that same principal, meaning yourself, if you are the one doing the advanced directive, also choose who you want to be your second or your third individual.
I understand that. Yes.
And did you also understand that the farm does, in fact, allow for you or anyone else to be able to have a statement or some other type of input in the sense of some type of summary of things that you would like for, such in your case?
Yeah, additional comments.
So, and the additional comments that the, you could actually direct the principal healthcare representative that if the first alternative is alternate is available, that you request that they have contact with them and discuss with them whatever decisions they might be wanting to make before they make that decision.
Yeah, I understand that, but the question I had was they are supposed to make effort to reach that person, but there's no guarantee how they do that. That is a very nebulous
Ms. Bridges,
thing, and I think it kind of gets into the weeds that
Ms. Bridges, don't you think that would be something that you'd want to take in consideration before you actually appointed whoever's going to be your principal individual, that you would
now
expect them to actually follow through with whatever suggestions, whatever comments you make? Or if you don't have faith in them, maybe you'd have someone else be in that position.
That was not what I was really referring to.
Okay. So let me ask you one other question, and that is, do you believe that an individual that is not related to the person making the executive advance directive, should be allowed if the person entering into that agreement, meaning the principal, chooses someone that's non-family because they feel that that person is going to be better equipped to carry out their wishes than what their own relatives might want to impose?
I don't recall that being actually described in this bill, but could I relate it, a circumstance where I believe that a person not related could definitely be appointed?
It can be. Right now, the way the procedure is set up is you, as the individual being the principal who's going to enter into the advance directive, have the right to select independently of anyone else who would be your principal health care representative.
Yeah.
That can be either a family member or it could be a non-family member. So my question is, do you believe that that individual who's wanting to enter into an advance directive should have the authority, should have the right to select whoever they want that's non-family member as compared to a family member?
I have no objection to that. In fact, I know of a circumstance where that person that apparently was designated, I don't know if they had an advance directive, ended up having a suit filed against her by the state guardian.
Thank you very much. Is there any other questions for Ms. Bridges? Thank you very much for coming back.
And I really appreciate your time.
You bet. So I'm now going to ask Colm Willis to please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you'll give us your name before your testimony, that would be wonderful.
Chair Przanski, members of this committee, my name is Colm Willis, and I am here at the request of Oregon Right to Life to ask you to oppose Senate Bill 494. I want to begin by saying that we agree with many of the sentiments expressed by the proponents of this bill, and we don't doubt the good intentions of many of the people and organizations who've worked on this bill. However, this bill makes a significant change in the authority of a healthcare representative to make life-ending decisions for an incapable person, and we believe that this could have serious consequences. Under current Oregon law, the default rule is that your healthcare representative cannot make life-ending decisions for you in most cases unless you expressly give them that authority, or if you're in one of four statutorily defined end-of-life situations. This is explicitly stated in ORS 127.531, which is the form, but it's also the case because the terms used in the form are defined in such a way that they're subject to ORS 127.535, 540, 580, and 635, which act as statutory limitations on the authority of a healthcare representative. Finally, this default rule is implied by the fact that a healthcare representative is defined in Oregon law to be acting under a power of attorney. However, if Senate Bill 494 becomes law, it would likely change this default, and it could be interpreted to mean that a healthcare representative can make life-ending decisions for you in most cases unless you clearly and unambiguously say that they can't, which may be difficult to do. The reason that Senate Bill 494 likely would have this effect is because it removes the form from statute and removes the explicit language in the form that requires you to expressly authorize your health care representative to make life-ending decisions in order for him or her to have that authority. It continues to use terms like tube feeding and life support, but it disconnects these terms from the statutory limitations on a health care representative, and it removes any reference to health care representative as a person acting under a power of attorney. Instead, Section 7 and Subsection 2A of the bill on page 10 simply states that the health care representative shall make decisions for the principal. The result of all this is that the bill would likely change the current default rule, which is that your health care representative may not make life-ending decisions for you in most cases, unless you say that they can, to a new rule, which would be that your health care representative may make life-ending decisions for you in most cases, unless you clearly and ambiguously say that they can't, which, as I said, may be difficult to do. This creates a situation where the intentions of a person filling out the advance directive may not be reflected in the decisions that are made for that person once they can no longer make decisions for themselves. And instead of the individual himself or herself having the power to determine what he or she wants, a healthcare representative or a court will do so. And this sort of case of ambiguity is what we saw in Southern Oregon, where the healthcare representative argued before a court that he was given the authority to determine whether or not the incompetent person had the ability or had should have assistance with ordinary eating and drinking. It was not clear from her advance directive whether or not she had given him that authority. And this problem goes back to what Sarah Kaufman of the Alzheimer's Association said on Friday, that a person who suffers from Alzheimer's disease or other diseases can be competent to make some decisions, but incompetent to make others. And this is true for many different diseases. For instance, a person could be incompetent to make complex medical decisions, but still be competent to decide whether or not he or she wants to eat or doesn't want to eat. And I think we would all agree to this principle, because it seems inherently repulsive to think of someone trying to force feed someone with Alzheimer's disease or dementia. We know implicitly that a person who's not capable of making many decisions in life may still have capacity to refuse to eat or choose to eat, and that person's will should be respected as long as possible. That's why it's so important that a healthcare representative only has the authority to make a life-ending decision for you if you explicitly give them that authority, because this is a permanent decision. And this preserves your ability to continue to make your own decisions so long as you have the power to do so, even after you start to become incompetent. As the Supreme Court has said in a case with facts similar to what we're talking about, even where family members are present, there will, of course, be some unfortunate situations in which family members will not act to protect a patient. And this is the kind of situation that we particularly want to avoid. And because of this, we ask you to oppose Senate Bill 494.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Manning first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have one question for you. We're talking about the design of the form. Would you agree or disagree that for someone to use the form would be strictly volunteer, they can choose to or not?
Choose to use the current form in statute?
Or any form, advance directive. It's up to the individual can choose or
yes.
not.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
All right. Colm, I guess a couple of different questions. You made reference to the case down in Southern Oregon. Is it true or it's, that the advance directive was upheld by the court,
yeah.
and the court actually made distinction as to compassionate food and drink is required under state statute. Mm-hmm. And so even though the individual, as the principal for the individual under the advance directives, thought that they had that control over whether or not compassionate food or drink should be provided, mm-hmm. the court said, yes, it should be, and it was, correct?
That's right.
Right. So it kind of, let's say, worked out, even though someone thought they had the power, the state statute said you don't have that power, and it wasn't written into it. And
that's
so
part the court, of the reason. Oh, sorry.
So, and the court did, in fact, enforce that.
That's right, and that's part of the reason we support the current law, because the judge publicly said she didn't agree with the outcome, but she did it because state law, she felt state law required her to do so,
right.
and we like that.
Right. And so where in the temporary form that's in Senate Bill 494 does it give a different outcome than what you just stated?
Well, this goes back to the question of authority. Of healthcare representative. So the argument that was specifically made in Southern Oregon, was that the principal, the protected person, the incompetent person, had given authority to her healthcare representative to make a decision about whether or not she should have assistance with ordinary eating and drinking. But as we said, in Oregon, the way the law works is you only have the right to make a life-ending decision for somebody if that person explicitly gave you that right. If the power was not explicitly given to you, then Oregon law presumes that you don't have that power. And so the first level of the analysis is really what authority does the healthcare representative have? And there's a tension in Oregon law between the rights that a person has and the limitations on the ability of the healthcare representative to make decisions for that person. But because there's a constitutional liberty interest that allows a person to refuse healthcare, this is the void that Fred Steele was talking about on Friday. There's this open question of, in the case where someone in their advance directive explicitly says, I don't want assistance with ordinary food and water, I think there's a question about whether or not that would be followed, and because they have a constitutional liberty interest. And so it wasn't a crazy argument that the person made. And what the bill does, Senate Bill 494, is it changes the default. So instead of the default being that a healthcare representative can't make a life-ending decision for somebody unless they're explicitly given the authority that they can, the default, and again, likely, it's not explicit, but based on my reading of the bill, it looks like the default would be that a person could make a life-ending decision for the principal, unless the principal clearly and unambiguously says that they can't. And the problem with that is because the terms are no longer connected to the limitations in the statute, the burden of the ambiguity falls on the person whose life could end.
All right. Colin, what I'm going to ask you to do is slide over one chair, because I'm going to ask legislative counsel to come up, because I have questions, and instead of going back and forth, I'd rather have them come up now, because my concern is my reading of the bill differs from what your interpretation is.
Sure.
As to the difference in the farms and changing the default as to who makes what decisions. My review of the temporary form compared to the current form is virtually verbatim, asking very similar questions as to what rights you want and what decisions you want your health care representative to make. So
could I, with permission, could I point out one difference that I think is relevant to this conversation?
Sure.
It would be in Section B of the current form and statute, where you appoint your healthcare representative. There's two sections. One is about life support, and one is about tube feeding. And in each case, it says, if you don't initial this space, then your representative may not decide about life support. And if you don't initial this space, then your representative may not decide about tube feeding. And that's not in the new form.
Mark?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I drafted the bill. I forgot to introduce my colleague properly on Thursday, Ms. Lori Sills. She actually used to work in estate planning before she was hired by our office, so a very valuable resource to our office for this conversation. I would like to respond briefly by just discussing the overarching way that the advance directive law works, and then go specifically into the forms, if that's okay. And then also, Ms. Sills performed some research for us down at Archives about the 1993 law and did some examination there that I would like her to be able to share with the committee as well.
And I've asked Legislative Council to do that research, so we will definitely take that. So
okay.
Go ahead.
I think the most important thing to understand about the way advance directive law works is that it is a mechanism by which a person may share their preferences for end-of-life care through a process to ensure that it is a genuine expression of those preferences. It has to be witnessed underneath current law. Underneath the new bill, it would have to be witnessed or notarized. It has to be filled out, and it has to be specific with what those choices are. Now, in the advanced directive law, a physician is not required to fulfill these wishes or desires. In fact, there's a statute. Let me get the correct number for you. ORS 127.625 that specifically says a physician does not have to withdraw life-sustaining procedures or tube feeding or whatever. It does set forth a process whereby that physician has to notify other people if they're unwilling to do that. The way advanced directive law works generally is it releases physicians and other people who may be involved in the process from any potential civil, criminal, or professional board disciplinary action with regard to acting in accordance with the wishes expressed in these documents. That's how it works. And that's why when it comes into conflict with rules or other statutes, those rules and other statutes will usually win out, to your question last Thursday, Senator Dumbro, because the way these generally work is release from liability. That's probably a fairly simplistic look at it. But if you understand that relationship between filling out the form and how it works in the hospital setting, then you'll understand basically overall what's happening. Specifically with to the forms themselves, and that aspect has not changed in this bill, by the way. We have not changed anything about liability in this bill. We have not changed anything about a physician's responsibilities in this bill. We haven't changed anything with respect to a healthcare representative's responsibilities in this bill. The form has changed, that's correct. With respect to how this new temporary form that will be available for 5 years, with respect to the decisions that it allows somebody to make, if you look on page 8 of the bill, lines 6, there is an overarching statement that is closely modeled after the current bill about statement regarding end-of-life care. You may initial the statement below if you agree with it. If you initial the statement, you may, but you do not have to, list one or more conditions for which you want to receive life support. And then you have to initial a statement if you do not want to receive life support. Lines 13 through 45 on page 8 and on page 9, lines 1 through 12, contain the same list of preferences that you may execute in the current advance directive with respect to whether you want to receive tube feeding or life support in specific situations. So those are the same, and they track the current law. More importantly, I think, is the committee, and this is, I think, the policy choice before you. On page 3, what the bill does is it instructs the committee to come up with an advance directive that has the following elements. Line 7. The form will have to have a statement about the purpose of the principals appointing a healthcare representative to make healthcare decisions if the principal becomes incapable. So there's going to be that statement in the new form that's adopted. Then it allows a statement about the principals expressing their values and beliefs with respect to healthcare decisions and with respect to healthcare, and preferences with respect to placement in a care home or mental health facility as opposed to following through on other parts of the advanced directive form. If you jump down on page 3 to line 26, the committee is instructed to include on the form a section providing the principal with an opportunity to state the principal's values and beliefs with respect to healthcare decisions, including the opportunity to describe the principal's preferences by completing a checklist, by providing instruction through narrative or other means, or by combination of methods to describe the principal's preferences regarding when the principal wants all reasonably available health care necessary to preserve life and recover, when the principal wants all reasonably available health care necessary to treat chronic conditions, when the principal wants to specifically limit health care necessary to preserve life and recover, including artificially administrated nutrition and hydration, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and transport to a hospital, and when the principal desires comfort care instead of health care necessary to preserve life. So those elements will have to be in the new form. In other words, the new form contains two elements. One, the decision will be made for you if you're incapable, not otherwise. And two, there will have to be a checklist or other means of writing in as in a narrative format how you feel about those four things I just read. So the choice is, I think for you guys, does that model closely after the current form? I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Sills now to discuss her research regarding power of attorney, if that's okay with you, Chair.
That'd be great.
All right.
Chair Przyginski, members of the committee, my name is Lori Sills. Like Mr. Mayor said, I'm a staff attorney at Legislative Council's office. I spent some time down at archives and was reading through the legislative history from 1993 when the current advanced directive form went into effect. And the reason that it is in its current form is actually in the late 80s, the legislature enacted statutes allowing individuals to appoint powers of attorney for healthcare, as well as give directives to physicians regarding medical treatment. Those were two separate statutory forms. They were enacted in 1989. And because the forms were bifurcated and separated, they actually created some confusion among healthcare professionals, among individuals executing them. They weren't sure what they did and who had the ultimate authority to make healthcare decisions. Because of this, in 93, after several years of discussing how to approach this and resolve the differences, the legislature decided to combine those two forms into one form, the current advanced directive. They took away the power of attorney for healthcare form and made the appointment occur only in that advanced directive form. The current bill simply changes terminology. It modifies the terminology that's used in the statute to take away reference to the power of attorney for healthcare and replace it with an appointment of a healthcare representative. Takes away reference to attorney in fact and replaces it with healthcare representative. The change in the terminology does not affect the duties or the authority of the power of attorney for healthcare or the healthcare representative. They continue to have the same responsibilities. So the current statute, ORS 127.510, provides that an attorney in fact, so appointed in an advance directive, shall make healthcare decisions on behalf of the principal if the principal becomes incapable. Senate Bill 494, Section 7, says that a healthcare representative appointed under this paragraph shall make healthcare decisions for the principal if the principal becomes incapable. The language in the bill mirrors the language in the current statute. It doesn't change anything other than the terminology. Under the current ORS 127.525, it states that subject to the right of an attorney in fact to withdraw the acceptance, an attorney in fact's acceptance of that position imposes a duty on the attorney in fact to make healthcare decisions on behalf of the principal at such time as the principal becomes incapable. Senate Bill 494, Section 12 imposes the same responsibility on a healthcare representative. It says that subject to the right of the healthcare representative or alternate healthcare representative to withdraw, the acceptance imposes a duty on the healthcare representative or the alternate healthcare representative to make healthcare decisions on behalf of the principal as described in ORS 127.510. The language in the bill, the current bill, mirrors language in the current statutes. It simply modifies the terms of referring to the healthcare representative versus the power of attorney for healthcare. Do you have any questions for me?
All right, questions of counsel regarding Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not seen the current form advanced directive. So I'm looking at the proposal for this particular one. are there sections in there that reference when you're talking about the person that's being appointed for a cell phone or for an email address?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Manning, would you give me just a second to look at this? And if you have another question while I'm looking, that'd be fine as well.
Well, I was just wondering. I'm asking the question because we're trying to, the intent of this is to modify, update this one, as I understand.
Correct. Senator Manning, obviously the current form doesn't have that. And I know for a fact, without having to examine it, that the language by which the committee will be adopting this will give them some flexibility with regard to the format that it takes place. Although the form for appointing a health care, which is going to be set forth in statute and not sunset, not go away, that form has to be attached to it underneath this law. So it's still going to have to be in a form-like setting. Now, as to the temporary form, I would have to look to see if that is allowed with how this is written. My guess is that since it's so closely modeled after the existing one, that it would present the same problems that the existing one does for those types of exchanging those types of documents in that way. But I know that the committee has a little bit more power to use different forms of technology for presenting the form to people.
All right. Any questions? All right, so I want to kind of go over a few things, and I guess start off, Colin, on Thursday when we had this hearing, there had been some concerns about the term healthcare representative being used. I just want to clarify, do you have an issue with that term as it as being used in the new form or in the existing law?
Our concern is that our understanding of what the bill would do is it would change the default authority of the healthcare representative. So that would be the concern.
So do you believe that a healthcare representative actually is an attorney in fact to make decisions as it pertains to the individual health care and what services or what procedures are going to be used?
That's what the statute says.
All right. So there was testimony from some of the individuals that came here, I assume at the request of Oregon Right to Life, that were concerned as to power of attorney being removed. I mean, the reality is we're not changing anything that's been in existence since 1993. In other words, the healthcare representative is the attorney in fact who has charged to by law to make certain decisions that have been granted to them by the principal of the advance directive. Is that a fair statement?
So our reading of the changes in the bill is that the current default rule is that a person does not have authority in most cases, with a few exceptions, to make a life-ending decision for an incompetent person unless they've explicitly been given that authority. And our reading of the bill is that this would change.
And where do you read that in the bill that changes that?
Sure. So the first part is in 531, which is the form itself, and this is what I pointed out earlier, where in Section B it says if you do not initial this space, then your representative may not decide about life support. And
Which page?
Sorry. So this is ORS 127.531. It's subsection 2, and it's in the form in Section B. Or Part B, I guess is what it says.
All right, I'm on Part B of the current form, and then looking at the temporary form that's in the statute.
So in the statutory form, it would be Part B, number 2 and number 3 that deal with life support and tube feeding. And in the new form, those statements do not exist.
Chair Pozanski, may I point out the pertinent section in the temporary form?
Yes.
Page 7, lines 30 through 37.
statements to my health care representative, one saying that they want their health care representative to follow their instructions explicitly, and the other one basically stating that their statements are guidelines for their health care representative to follow.
So in other words, they're giving and they're expressly stating whether they want the health care representative to follow the document within the four corners of that document as to what they expressly gave permission to, or if they choose to do so, they're allowing for their health care representative to have more flexibility in making their decisions. Would that be a fair assessment of what the changes is?
Yes, Chair Przanski, that would be correct.
I think there might be some confusion about what I was saying. So the reason why these are relevant is because the term life support and the term tube feeding are defined in ORS 127.505
right.
And are tied to the terms artificially administered nutrition and hydration and the term life-sustaining procedure. And the reason that's relevant is because in ORS 127.540, the statute explicitly says that this chapter of the statute does not authorize an appointed health care representative to make a decision with respect to withholding or withdrawing life-sustaining procedure, or with respect to withholding or withdrawing artificially administered nutrition or hydration, unless certain, basically you're in certain situations or the principal expressly gives you the authority. So
right.
What I was saying was the default has changed. Not that a person can't be specific. That's kind of what's changed is the default. So the default now is unless you give specific authority, your healthcare representative can't make a life-ending decision in most cases. The change would be that that's no longer the default.
So, but I guess I'm kind of confused and baffled by your argument. And when you look at the page 7 of the bill under, as Mark Mayer has stated, under 4 directions to my healthcare representative, line 30 through 37, my reading of this is pretty explicit that individual principal who's entering into this agreement is giving their direction as to what they do or don't want their health care representative to do.
Right.
And so
sure.
Just because it's in the, let's say, the front portion of the form, I'm not sure why that differs as to having something maybe explicitly written somewhere else. If you're giving that individual the default to make those decisions, that's what they are being given the authority to do.
The issue is, where does the burden lie when there's ambiguity? So because...
You've already given us the example of what happened down in the Southern Oregon case. I mean, clearly, if you have a difference of opinion, many cases requires it to go to a court for litigation or for a determination mm-hmm. as to what or what isn't going to be permitted or not permitted under the, in this case, the advanced directive. And you've already borne out that in that particular case where the individual who had the, who was the primary health care representative had a belief as to what they could or couldn't do, but the court said, no, this is what the law is, and this is what you have to do. So I'm not sure how we ever insulate any farm from ever having a dispute as to taking it to a third party, in this case a magistrate, a judge, to make that determination.
Yeah, so I agree with you that at the end of the day, a judge is going to make this determination. The question is, in the new form, it's when someone says, you have to follow my instructions, and then they write instructions, and it's unclear whether those instructions give the healthcare representative the authority to make a life-ending decision for that person or not.
Right.
Right?
That's where it goes to the judge.
Well, but the issue is one of authority. When it's unclear, does the healthcare representative have the authority to make that decision when it's unclear specifically what the principal's intentions were? And my understanding of the current law is that when it's unclear, then the healthcare representative does not have the authority to make a life-ending decision, and that's not clear in the new bill.
Isn't that the view of the beholder as to what they think is or isn't clear? Because whoever's on the other side of that argument could go to the court and say, I think I do have clarity here. I do believe I have this authority. And then the judge, he or she, is going to make that final decision.
Yes, correct. Right. But the
let me ask you a couple other questions now. Regarding the change of having a committee actually come forward in the next 4 years to actually bring a farm to the legislature. Clearly, my reading of the statute, they have an obligation, they have a duty, they have a to actually bring whatever work they put together to the legislature. Do you disagree that they have an ability to not submit their work to the four committees that we've heard that are they're supposed to give this information to?
My understanding of the change is that under current law, in order to change the form, you need the normal legislative process. A bill needs to be passed by both chambers and signed by the governor. If this bill is passed, that would change, and instead a new form could be made by the rulemaking process. And as a part of that process, they would have to submit the form to the four chairs of four committees in the legislature, but the form would not have to be adopted by both chambers, and the bill would not have to be signed by the governor.
Doesn't have to be. That's correct. So basically you agree that whatever work is done by this commission, they are going to have to submit it to the legislature for review.
They would have to submit it to the four chairs of the four committees.
Which are part of the legislature, correct?
There are four members of the legislature, yes.
All right. And then those individuals would make some decisions as to whether they think they should either schedule it for some type of hearing or based on the presentation. And I'm going to use the example, which you're probably familiar with, the Oregon Council of Court Procedures, where they do, in fact, have the same type of structure that's been in existence, as I said earlier, since 1979 for 38 years. It's a public body who actually is dictated and mandated to actually come up with Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, as we know in the field, ORCPs. And so if you go to their website today and look, they will actually say, we have submitted to the 2017 legislature modifications to X number of rules, which they explicitly state out. So it seems to me that as they basically put in there, and then there's the disclaimer that if the legislature chooses not to do anything, these amendments will go into effect. So understanding that's how that procedure works, same thing would be happening here is what I would surmise, is that if and whatever changes they're going to make, it's going to be publicly announced, and it would in fact allow anyone in this process, whether it be an individual citizen or any other legislator besides the four that gets the bill, to actually have a bill drafted to make modifications or to challenge or to change whatever those amendments, proposed amendments are. Do you disagree with that?
So my understanding of what the bill would do is currently, in order to change the form, you would have to pass a law through both chambers and have it signed by the governor. If Senate Bill 494 is enacted and becomes law, then you would have to pass a bill through both chambers and have it signed by the governor to stop the new form from being promulgated. So that's my understanding of the difference.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much. All right, with that, I believe we've concluded our testimony, but I did want to ask, Colin, why don't you just stay down there, for a second, because I understand Gail Atterbury, she left, huh? Okay, so since you represent Right to Life, can you tell us what, if anything, your law firm did in preparing any materials for your client to disseminate to others regarding Senate Bill 494? Or the process that would be used for advanced directives?
I can't speak for my law firm. I had numerous conversations with Gail Atterbury and discussed with her my understanding of the current law and what changes the bill proposed. That was the extent of my involvement.
Right. Did you provide her with any documentation that later was used to send out notices to people within their e-serve list?
No, I did not have anything involved. I did not have any involvement with their email system.
Did you participate in assisting in recruiting any witnesses to give testimony in opposition of the bills that are before us today?
I did not.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. That concludes our public hearing on Senate Bill 494, as well as on 768, I believe, is the other number. Just make sure we got that right. And so we'll close that public hearing. At this point, we're going to continue on our next project, which I believe is Senate Bill 49. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 49. Josh, if you can give us the overview, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 49 addresses fitness to proceed in juvenile delinquency proceedings. The introduced bill prohibits removing a youth from their current placement for an evaluation for fitness to proceed and requires the community mental health director to determine that inpatient treatment is medically necessary before the youth may be removed from their current placement for restorative services. There is a dash one amendment before you that authorizes removal of the youth for purposes of the evaluation only if the youth is detained in a detention facility, requires that the youth be returned to their original placement following the completion of restorative services unless the youth was originally placed in a detention facility. Finally, the dash one amendment directs the Oregon Health Authority to coordinate with the Department of Human Services, Juvenile Department, and the youth's family in placing the youth in appropriate facilities for restorative services. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So, Colum Willis, I think he's left. His name was on this form, and we think that he made a mistake in wanting to sign up for the bills that we just heard. So unless he comes back in, we only have one person signed up at this time, Nicole Corbin. Nicole, if you'll come forward. While she's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 49? When you're ready.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Przanski, Co-Chair Thatcher, Vice Chair Thatcher. I'm Nicole Corbin, the Adult Services Manager for the Adult Behavioral Health Services Manager. Got to get all those words in for the Oregon Health Authority Health Systems Division. And thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of Senate Bill 49. As you recall, if a youth is accused of a crime but also has a mental illness, the court can question whether or not the defendant can aid and assist the attorney in the criminal defense. If the court suspects that a mental illness may be preventing a youth from being able to aid and assist in defense, the judge will order a competency evaluation to determine the fitness to proceed in these criminal proceedings. For adults, this is usually referred to as a 370 evaluation, referring to the governing statute ORS 161.370. For kids, the juvenile fitness to proceed process is separate and distinct. It was established by House Bill 2836 during the 2013 legislative session to create a standardized process so juvenile courts in Oregon could implement for both evaluations, assessing a kid's fitness to proceed, and providing restorative services to that youth found unfit to proceed in juvenile court. The governing statute for youth is ORS 419C.380. A primary tenet of this legislation is that youth are not to be removed from their current placements for either an evaluation or to receive restorative services, except if that removal is necessary for the provision of those restorative services. Since this legislation, the Oregon Health Authority has developed a statewide restorative services program that's capable of providing these restorative services for youth on an outpatient basis anywhere within the state. The service delivery is not dependent on the youth's placement and can follow a youth should that youth's placement change. This allows those restorative services to be administered without disrupting other treatment that the youth may need. If a youth is ordered to be removed from his or her current placement, and by placement we mean where they live, their treatment home, their foster home, their facility, we don't mean jail or a correction system center. If they're ordered removed from their current placement for the purposes of restorative services, the Oregon Health Authority opens a bed for that youth at the Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program, SAPE for short, at the Children's Farm Home. This is the most intensive level of care in Oregon's behavioral health system and functions as a state psychiatric hospital for youth. There, in situations like this where a kid is referred to SAPE, OHA has 7 days to provide for the youth's intake. There are a limited number of SAPE beds, and there is consistently a waiting list for these beds. This means that if a youth is ordered to be removed from their current setting for restorative services, that some youth who's already at SAPE has to leave and be placed elsewhere, or that youth who are waiting for admission to SAPE for reasons outside of the criminal justice system have to wait longer, and they're usually in a crisis situation. Now, most of the time, if a youth is ordered to receive restorative services on an inpatient basis, it's necessary and appropriate, right? Their level of clinical need requires that level of intervention, but not always. At times, a youth is ordered into SAFE for restorative services who doesn't require that intensive level of care. Other times, a youth might have initially required that intensive level of care and needed to be at SAPE, but after treatment for a while, they become more appropriate for a different level of care. So Senate Bill 49 is an attempt to address these issues. This bill allows the Oregon Health Authority to work with system partners to provide, identify more appropriate settings for the youth while the youth is receiving restorative services. This will help ensure that the youth residing in SAPE are the kids who need that high level of service the most, and will allow the Oregon Health Authority to provide restorative services in the most appropriate setting, not necessarily the most intensive setting. The proposed Dash 1 amendment clarifies, as I said before, that current placement does not refer to a juvenile detention facility or a youth correctional facility. It clarifies that a youth in these facilities at the time he or she is found unfit to proceed doesn't need to remain in detention for the duration of restorative services. It also allows the Oregon Health Authority to work with system partners to make the most appropriate settings available for youth. So this legislation makes small changes that allow for more flexibility in serving youth in the environment that most closely meets their needs throughout the entire restorative services process, and it'll help ensure the youth's stable placements following the completion of restorative services. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today. The Oregon Health Authority supports this bill, and we hope that you will as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions for Nicole? You did great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, again, I'm going to ask if anyone else wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 49. Not seeing anyone come forward. We'll go ahead and close that public hearing. And where are we at? All right, so this one here, we need to hold on because we don't have everything ready. All right. So that's going to conclude our work for today. We will not be doing any work sessions today. With that, we're going to go ahead and adjourn for the day, and we'll be back here tomorrow, Tuesday, at 8 o'clock. We're adjourned. 8 o'clock. We're adjourned. Tuesday.